So it's a pleasure for all of us to be a part of the third annual Unite to Heal campaign, which is in support of the incredible work and the important work of Amudim. My name is Shai Schefter. I'm one of the Rabbanim at the Young Israel of Woodmere. And I was asked to come join a panel of other Rabbanim to talk about not only the amazing work of Amudim, which I venture to say all of us and so many of our colleagues all over the country have made use of when we have situations in our communities that arise, which clearly are out of our depth and beyond our league, but things that we need to pass on to professionals and to organizations that really strive at helping the community members who need their help. And as we know, Amudim is something that helps not only with many mental health crises and many issues, but obviously those who are struggling with all kinds of addictions, and most prominently those who unfortunately go through a traumatic experience of abuse in so many different ways. And we have all turned to Amudim at many different times in our lives and in our careers to try to get some assistance, to get perspective, and to try to help people as much as we can. So it's really a pleasure for all of us to be here. I want to just introduce the panelists who are going to be sharing with us what I believe is a very powerful conversation. And as we know, whenever we have shailas, whenever we have questions that arise in our communities as individuals and certainly as Rabbanim, so we have to do our best to try to look at all the angles and evaluate all the different sides and try to understand what's really beneath the question. And is there something that's beyond what's being presented that we maybe need to consider or need to think about? And this is something that is part of the incredible challenge that we face, especially in light of the mental health issues that sometimes need to be considered. And it's something that that all of our colleagues try our best to be sensitive toward and to be understanding about. And what we're going to talk about today is different kinds of questions that have come up in our communities where we have opportunities to think not only about the strict letter of the law, not only about the halacha itself, but to think beyond that, to try to consider a number of other factors that may be presenting themselves in the questioner who is presenting. So with us today on the panel, and we thank all of the Rabbanim for making time in their busy schedules to be a part of this, and to be a part of helping to support Amudim and their very, very noble and special work. So the first panelist that we have is Rabbi Larry Rothwax, who is a Rav in Congregation Beth Aaron in New Jersey, in Teaneck. And he's also the Director of Professional Rabbinics at REITS, which is so much an integral part of teaching young musmachim about these very issues and trying to make sure that they understand that not only is learning important, not only is mastery of information important, but professional rabbinics is also important, and to have a perspective of how to deal with somebody who comes to talk to a young musmach with a question. Our second panelist is Rabbi Daniel Feldman, who is a Rav also in Teaneck in Congregation Or Sadia, and also serves as a Rosh Hashiva at REITS, but is very, very well known for his Svarim that have become very popular over the many years that they've been published on a range and array of topics, both in English as well as in Hebrew. Focusing very often on issues of Ben Adam LaChavero. And he has written so extensively on so many of the things we're going to talk about today. And I encourage all of you to try and find some of his articles and some of his writings online to educate yourselves a little bit more about the very incredible perspective that he shares on so many issues that we're going to talk about. And finally, Rabbi Ari Leibowitz, who's the Rav of Beis Knesses in North Woodmere, also a Mechaber Svarim, a popular series called Hakone Olamo, which also deals with very much halacha lemaisa issues and dealing with human complexities and the shailas that come up in communities, but is also the director of smicha at REITS and has such a perspective from the many, many talmidim that he has helped to guide in their paths and their journeys in the rabbanim. So we're going to jump right into this, and maybe just the format that we're going to have is each of the rabbanim will share some stories, some anecdotes, some questions that have come up, and we should all feel comfortable to comment on each other and to fill in whenever there's an appropriate need to do so. So maybe we'll begin with Rabbi Rothwax, who can share a scenario with us and give us somewhat of a perspective.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Schefter. And it's a great personal honor to have the opportunity to participate in this important conversation. My personal goal is to try to stay as much as I can out of the way so we can learn from Rabbi Feldman, Rabbi Leibowitz. If I've been successful with the help of Hashem in any way whatsoever, it's some people have entrusted me with you know, some very delicate questions and dilemmas that they have faced. And I've had the opportunity over the years to, you know, to try to assist people from wherever they were in trying to offer them personal guidance and, whenever appropriate, halacha guidance as well. I think that all of us today have a little bit of a dilemma because we want to be able to really share with the community some of what's going on out there, because I think there's great benefit and there's something very validating for each and every one of us to know that some of the real struggles that we maybe experience personally within our family, within our inner circles, are shared by many, many people at the community. At the same time, I think we want to all make sure that we are being respectful and mindful of people's privacy, and most importantly, make sure that individuals feel that they can ask a shaila to a rav and not be concerned that it is going to be shared with the public. So I think that all of us are committed to trying to share, you know, shaylas by preserving their integrity, but at the same time, you know, doing so in a way that no way whatsoever would disclose the identity or any particulars of the questions. So I'm going to start off with a fascinating shaila that was shared with me years ago. I imagine that some of the questions we're going to deal with today may be rather intense, and we're going to deal with, I'm sure, some very, very serious shaylas. This is a very intriguing question, not one that involves pikuach nefesh, but one that I think for myself personally was sort of like a gateway in terms of my own thinking and appreciation of how complex some mental health issues are, particularly as they intersect with halacha. A number of years ago, I was involved in a situation where there was as a young man who had become bar mitzvah within the past year. And it was so long ago, and I was not actually at the time sophisticated enough to be able to really comment much in terms of what was going on from a mental health perspective. But in retrospect, I think that this was an individual who probably had, somewhat of an obsessive personality, combined with what at the time was maybe some sort of confused or maybe, you know, complicated ideological perspectives on animals and our relationship with animals. And the divergence of those two led to the following situation, and that is that he did not feel comfortable having to do anything having to do with leather. He wouldn't wear leather shoes. He wouldn't wear leather belts. He wouldn't wear leather yarmulkes. If I remember correctly, he wouldn't even want to sit on a leather seat. It was really extreme. We're not talking about somebody who just, was a vegetarian or was choosing, you know, not to eat, byproducts of animals. This was really extreme. As he became a bar mitzvah, obviously became an issue with him when he was putting on tefillin. He was encouraged at the time to try his best. And even though he didn't particularly enjoy it and he found it to be uncomfortable for him, to push his way through. But over the course of several months, this became a real struggle for him, to the point where what he described and certainly what he displayed was a tremendous amount of personal anguish wearing tefillin. It was painful for him. It literally brought tears to his eyes. And you didn't get the impression that this was an individual who was looking to be difficult. He was not rebellious per se. He wasn't, as far as you can tell in every area, he was committed to living a life of Torah mitzvos. But this particular mitzvah, obviously a very important one, presented him with an extraordinary challenge. So I will now open the floor and allow Rabbi Leibowitz and Rabbi Feldman, who, you know, were not there at the time, to share any thoughts that they may have in terms of, I think that we want to try to keep this conversation focused on two things at the same time. You know, what are some of the halachic issues and what's an approach that maybe we would take, but at the same time to realize and to appreciate, you know, the human struggle here, and to understand, you know, how complicated and not necessarily intuitive, you know, some of the real struggles, mental health struggles that people encounter.
Well, I'll speak first just to frame the question further, so then I can shift over to Rabbi Leibowitz. But before even addressing the specifics, although it's very relevant to trying to understand exactly from what direction to come, just to clarify, this is an issue that can come from a mental health perspective, but can also come from a shita, can also come from someone's attitude towards, say, veganism and animal rights. And I've heard the question in that context also. So if the question is being asked by someone who feels philosophically that he has no right to use leather in any form, and therefore that extends to not even wearing tefillin, that would require one kind of level of understanding and approach. while it sounds like from what you're describing that it's not necessarily coming from an intellectual or a philosophical place, but rather it's more of an emotional reaction that's not the kind that can be addressed from that type of perspective. Is that an accurate frame?
Yeah, that is correct. That was very much my impression at the time. And I think in that regard, it is what makes it somewhat unusual. I think we would more naturally expect that it would be more Vashita. But in this case, I think it was an underlying pathology. And even though I'm not going to try to, you know, offer a clinical diagnosis at the moment, I think it's clear to say that the way he was presenting was that this was a real, real struggle for this individual and not something that he just needed to, you know, try to adjust his thinking in terms of, you know, his worldviews of philosophies. Yeah.
When it comes from that perspective, that if one feels an enormous discomfort that they are not able to overcome, so then it probably enters into some of the literature that we know in this group that Rav Asher Weiss has discussed extensively, for example, to parallel the question of dalakosos, where it comes up that sometimes there are impediments to someone being able to perform a mitzvah that are not necessarily life-threatening, but create some kind of a debilitating condition, whether it's physical or mental. And being that we know that they can be of equal difficulty, whether they are physical or mental, so without coming to a conclusion on this point, but there is a literature about that, that we don't necessarily assume that even when dealing with a positive mitzvos, that we have only a dispensation when it's in the category of life or death, but sometimes when something is really incapacitating, so then that opens up another avenue. Where that avenue will go, again, is not something we can conclude so easily, but in some contexts, it's brought from a kal vachomer for monetary expenditure, that we know that tefillin, as important as it is, yet is still subject to a limitation when it comes to expenditure of one-fifth of your money. It's in the category of chomesh. So a incapacitation that is so absolute, even it's going to be subject to how exactly you assess it, theoretically would bring up some of that literature.
I would suggest, along the lines of what Rav Feldman is saying, that we know when it comes to avoiding violating a lo saseh, a law in the Torah, a person has to give up all of their money. But when it comes to fulfilling a mitzvah saseh, so it's only ad chomesh lechasav, up until 20% of your money. If I'm not mistaken, in a tshuva relating to an almana covering her hair, after she's no longer married, but she's in shiduchim now, and technically, strictly speaking, she's supposed to still cover her hair. I think in that context, Rav Moshe writes that if it's so traumatic for her, or it's something that's so difficult for her, that she would sooner give up 20% of her money rather than do this mitzvah, that would be beyond what the Torah expects of her in that mitzvah. Now, that's in that specific circumstance, we're covering the hair, Rav Moshe suggests, is only perhaps a mitzvah saseh, rather than for a married woman where it's a lo saseh, so no one should extrapolate about hair covering in general. But when it comes to mitzvah saseh, we typically assume that if it's the type of trauma that you would sooner give up 20% of your money than to have to fulfill the mitzvah, that it could be that one is exempt from fulfilling the mitzvah. There are a couple of other factors, though, that have to be taken into account. First of all, it's not so clear that if it's not just a one-time mitzvah, but it's a constant, where every moment you're getting a new mitzvah, that we would have that same measuring stick of 20%. I mean, for example, the Minchas Chinuch writes that when it comes to the mitzvah of mezuzah, where every second is a new kiyum mitzvah, it could be you have to spend way more than 20% of your money on mezuzah. And when it comes to wearing tefillin also, each moment that a person is wearing tefillin is a new kiyum mitzvah. It's not the same to put on tefillin for 30 seconds as it is to put on tefillin for 45 minutes. It's not like netilas lulav or something like that, although lulav is its own discussion, so maybe I shouldn't have given that as an example. But it's not necessarily a one-time mitzvah. And the longer, you know, some of the posts can recommend, I heard Moreno of Shechter Shlita suggest for someone who missed putting on tefillin one day, wear your tefillin twice as long tomorrow. Meaning, even though each and every day there is a chiyuv to put on tefillin, but each and every moment there's a kiyum mitzvah of tefillin. On the flip side, one always has to be mindful of long-term goals and short-term gains. Meaning, if pressuring a person to do a mitzvah is going to create such a traumatic experience that forever there will be a negative association with this mitzvah. And then once the person gets to a healthier place, there's still not, it's going to be a trigger. That mitzvah is going to become a trigger for them. So then it could be that we're really shooting ourselves in the foot by putting too much pressure to do the mitzvah. Obviously, as both Rabbi Rothbach and Rabbi Feldman pointed out, this is really a case-by-case basis where a person has to really, really assess the situation, what the long-term impact is going to be, what the short-term impact is going to be, what the attitude of the person actually is, and obviously in consultation with a mental health professional who's familiar with the case, not just a mental health professional in general, which, by the way, I don't know if it was mentioned, Rabbi Rothbach is a mental health professional in addition to his rabbinic duties, but a mental health professional who is who's familiar with the case.
I think it's worth mentioning also, once we're talking about this, that sometimes community members who hear about such a question don't really fully appreciate the struggle that the individual is having and don't really understand what the question is. I remember, for example, there was a woman who had posed the question, as Rabbi Leibowitz mentioned before. So he spoke about the variation that Rav Moshe has about an almana who's now in Shidduchim and covering her hair. But there were a number of situations where women came to discuss a question about covering their hair. They are married, and they just said that they have terrible migraines, terrible headaches every time that they have anything on top of their heads. Now, that's a question which obviously, again, needs to be a very case by case and not to extrapolate from. But I remember mentioning it to someone else in the community, and he said, come on, just do it. What could it actually do? You put something on your head, like, is it really bothering her? How much can it bother her already? She should just do it. And I think there needs to be an effort to try to educate people that they need to be mindful of the fact that, yes, there are some people who have conditions or who have situations that maybe you don't experience and maybe you don't fully understand, but it doesn't just mean that, you know, it doesn't just mean that they have to suffer and that they need to, ignore or suppress that struggle. It's something that needs to be spoken about and dealt with. And obviously these questions are dealt with. And sometimes the answer is, yes, you need to suffer and you need to struggle and that's what it is. But very often, that is not the case, and there is a discussion in halacha to be had.
I was just wondering from the other rabbanim, I've had several shailas that relate to what's called exposure therapy and what the limits are, and maybe they had similar shailas and how to navigate this kind of situation. I'll just give two quick examples. Exposure therapy, from what I understand, and Rabbi Rothbach can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, is the idea that if a person has, whether it be an OCD or an anxiety that relates to a particular area, a particular topic, where they have extreme attitudes or extreme thoughts, that you sort of expose them. Like if a person is terrified of cats and can't walk on a block that has cats on the block, or that they once saw a cat on the block, that they're that they then slowly you expose them a little bit more to the source of their trauma, and they grow accustomed to it and they get used to it. So I had two cases, one where a guy was struggling with OCD and anxiety, and he had these very extreme thoughts that he thought that any time he thought negatively of somebody, it constituted a tefillah that the person should suffer. And he believed that his thoughts were actually making people suffer because he was davening that they should suffer. And this was a result of something that happened in childhood, that he had wished ill on somebody, and the person really suffered pretty terribly shortly thereafter. And the therapy, the way this therapist had recommended, was to say out loud that he wants something negative to happen to somebody. And I don't know that you're allowed to do that. Generally speaking, it's not nice to say, you know, to curse a person and to say that you want something bad to happen to somebody else. Another situation was a person who had, you know, who had OCD relating to religious behavior of people around him, that he just couldn't handle when anyone spoke any avak lashon hara or any nivel peh, anything of that nature. And what the therapist recommended was that he either say or hear nivel peh, bad words, and by being exposed to them and not reacting to them, that it would be helpful to him to function like a more normal person in his day-to-day life. And you know, each case is different, but I just wonder if you've ever had either questions about that or, you know, have any insight onto the effectiveness of such such treatment and what the limits of exposure therapy might be.
As far as that first point about somebody who feels that what he says is harmful to people, so we know there is a concept of a klala, and we know that there's an isser in the Torah of cursing people, although it was somewhat of a debate as to whether it's because we connect that to any real-world effect. The Rambam didn't think there was any real-world effect, but he did certainly believe there was still a prohibition nonetheless. And in his view, Futner has an essay about this, that it probably connects to the broader goal of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha, and not subtracting from how people are felt and experienced and the love that's supposed to be directed towards them. But also, especially what you're referring to, that somebody feels that they want somebody to suffer. So by definition, that certainly seems to fly in the face of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha. If you love anyone else as yourself, you're not going to want them to suffer. But what's particularly striking about this is that the one who's struggling with this is struggling so much because he doesn't want it to happen. Because deep down, the yid inside very much doesn't want there to be any real world effect and doesn't want the person to suffer. So I think that might be an opening point to consider as far as the paths that he needs to take in order to get to that result. Now, what it's very difficult in this case is to understand exactly why speaking it out loud is going to be helpful to him. I just can only speculate as a layman that perhaps being confronted more absolutely with the reality of it is a step towards then actually dismantling it, as opposed to a thought which remains somewhat unaddressed. I don't know if that's the nature of it. But overall, certainly we have a great discomfort with saying that anyone else should suffer, whether it actually constitutes a klal or whether it's a more broader kind of objection. But the fact that this individual is so troubled specifically because of that, because in real life, that's the last thing he wants to actually happen. And to whatever extent this may help to mitigate that and to bring him to a place where he's not even having these thoughts in the first place. So the worthiness of that goal is something to hold on to. How much you can accomplish with that is probably more in the hands of the professionals in this area.
It struck me as a little risky also, meaning he's going to say something out loud that he wants something negative to happen to somebody. And what if it happens? You know, then it's going to send him back, I would imagine.
Right. So the nature of that, I think this would also be a case where for the rabbi to speak directly to the therapist, if possible, and to understand how this is supposed to help and how it's supposed to operate. And I think we've all had the experience that there are therapists who are more connected to our value system and less connected to our value system, but also some who speak more generally and more specifically. So it's one thing to say, I'm scared of something. So to confront it more directly is going to help me eventually become less scared. It's probably another thing to say that one should be encouraged to say horrible things because they have an aversion to these horrible things. And maybe they should have an aversion to those horrible things. And what exactly is the nature of that aversion? And where do we draw the line between the appropriate aversion and an incapacitating aversion?
Yeah, I agree 100%, especially because the in these types of situations, we're talking about exposure therapy for anxieties, for phobias, there is a fair degree of flexibility that the therapist has. This is not, it's not regulated by, you know, when it comes to medication, for example. While there may be different types of medications to address certain illnesses, generally speaking, you know, the pharmacology is what it is. I mean, there's not all that much flexibility when it comes to designing a protocol to help somebody experience less anxiety and to face some of their fears and challenges. There can be a lot of flexibility. And I think more often than not, as Rabbi Feldman said, a lot more is accomplished when the Rav can interact directly with the therapist. And sometimes there's not even a conflict of values, as much as the therapist didn't necessarily understand and appreciate that, you know, that there was some tension there. I remember years ago, there was a young woman in the community who was going through a very difficult time in her life. And she spent a lot of time horseback riding. And she was spending almost every day of the week, and she reached a point where she wanted to go horseback riding on Shabbos as well. And she asked me if this was something that she could do. She had been in a very compromised state for a long period of time, and this was, you know, she had reached the point in her recovery where, you know, this was giving her a tremendous amount of chizuk in many ways. So there's a particular Rav, a posek, who had been very involved in helping and guiding this family through many of the challenges that they faced. So I went to him and I asked him if it would be permissible for her to go on Shabbos. And he didn't need a lot of background because he was already familiar with the case. And he said 100%. 100%. And it's just a matter of the details. How is she going to get there? And we have to work that out. But in no way whatsoever should we stand in her way if this is what she needs and it'll continue to give her the nachas ruach, etc. The therapist heard about this. And the therapist, to my knowledge, if I remember correctly, was not Jewish and certainly not an observant Jew, said absolutely not. She may not go on Shabbos. There's nothing to discuss here. Because from the therapist's perspective, this wasn't necessary. This girl needed to experience a little discomfort of sitting around one day of the week and not being able to do what it was that brought her, you know, tremendous relief. For me personally, that was a fascinating moment where I saw a clash of two worlds, but it was completely flipped in the way we would naturally expect. And bringing rabbis and therapists together can teach us a lot, not only about halacha, but about mental health. And don't assume that the rabbi is always going to be the machmir and the therapist is always going to be pushing this way. Sometimes, you know, everybody just needs to speak to each other and there can be a lot of benefit on all sides.
Just for the record, that case of the obsessive thoughts, it was the therapist that asked the question. It was a frum therapist who was a rabbi also, but asked the question whether he can recommend that as a course of treatment.
I don't know if this was the tshuva that was referenced earlier, but in the second volume of Rav Asher Weiss's tshuvas, there is a revolutionary tshuva on OCD. And I think there I don't know if he's speaking about exposure therapy per se, but he does outline certain klalim, basically sort of what was said before, lose the battle, win the war. Sometimes you need to really think big picture over here. And I think, you know, speaks about, you know, Sam Sofer, who says that if a person is wandering in the desert on Shabbos, we do not impose upon him the requirement to, well, he's lost in the desert, doesn't know what day it is. So when it comes to the seventh day, he's not bound by the halachos of Tchum Shabbos, because otherwise he's never going to get out of there. And I think you get takes a gadol of Yisrael to think in these terms and to imply these klalim in these types of situations. But it's very, very important to remind ourselves that we have to be willing to explore all possibilities. That doesn't mean that everything's going to be okay, but because the alternative sometimes is the person can really be trapped.
If I recall correctly, Rav Asher Weiss's shayla was about a Talmud Chacham who had OCD about davening, and he would constantly repeat words in davening. And Rav Asher told him to never repeat words in any of your brachos or tefillos, no matter how certain you are that you didn't get it right. And then, like you said, like Rabbi Rothbach said, that was his logic, that you have to keep the big picture in mind. He quoted a Chasam Sofer about a shota that has a chance at a refua in a mental institution that doesn't serve kosher food, and then he could stay there because atu chayavim lahashiro shota upatam min mitzvos. Well, you want him to remain a shota his entire life and be part of a mitzvos, you have to keep the long-term goal in mind.
So I will say that although that tshuva is printed and it's specifically talking about OCD, we once had a shayla here about exposure therapy in particular, and it was a much more chamer shayla than the ones that were presented. It had to do with inyanei arayos potentially, and it was a very, very serious shayla, and I did present it, and I'm not going to get into the exact particulars of the answer or the case because, you know, again, it's just very personal, but a lot of the logic that was used there was also that same Chasam Sofer, that if we don't figure out how to use the exposure therapy to think about the long-term goal and the long-term healthy vision that this person can have on their journey moving forward, then they're just going to be debilitated for years to come and they won't be able to do many other things. I do remember a number of years ago when I introduced Rav Asher Weiss to Dr. Pelkowitz, and they were having a conversation about a particular issue. It was a more general conversation, but then at some point they spoke about a particular issue that was on both of their minds and a certain condition. And Dr. Pelkowitz asked a very compelling question. When I have a patient like this, or when a therapist is faced with a situation where, on the one hand, you have to worry about the psychological issue that's going on and the mental health component of it, which is obviously very serious. At the same time, as a result of this condition, this individual is now giving up on religion. And very often we find that happens. So which one should I be focusing on first? Which one takes the primary role? Should I first be working only on the mental health? Should I be paying attention at the same time? Should I do parallel therapies and have two different therapists seeing this individual? And Rav Asher Weiss was very clear in his answer, and he said, if you're not alive, you can't be frum. So he basically was telling him that the first thing that needs to be taken care of is you need to make sure the person is healthy and stable and strong enough to be living life and living the journey and experiencing life and going through it in a healthy way. Everything after that is secondary. And only once a person is healthy do they have the ability to then be frum and to consider that.
Just to add on the flip side of that, though, we also heard from Rav Asher Weiss once that what makes mental health treatments particularly challenging, more so than physical health treatments, is that typically there's more certainty in the treatment when it comes to physical health, that this is the treatment that will work, no other treatment will work, and this treatment has a track record of working. There are certain therapies that you could perhaps say that about, but there are a lot of things that may be suggested as a course of therapy by one mental health professional that maybe, the mental health professional may be just trying something, and has very little certainty of whether it's going to be effective. And it's not certain at all that it's the only course of treatment. So I know in a certain very Chamor Arayos case, which I'm not going to share the details, not because I'm trying to protect anyone's privacy, but just because I don't remember the details. I remember Rav Asher Weiss also said, I mean, I would try to protect someone's privacy also, but I happen to not remember the details. Rav Asher Weiss said that they couldn't pursue a particular path of treatment because it's not so clear that that path of treatment was the only way to help. And what was even going to help. But this is why everything's on a case-by-case basis.
The flip side of exposure therapy, just another type of question that Rabbanim will get, is in the management of addiction sometimes, there's an approach that's called harm reduction, in which a person is addicted to a particular behavior, which is harmful, in some cases, usher as well, and I think it would almost always be both. And whether it's after failed efforts to eliminate the addictive behaviors, to break these patterns, or maybe it's just under the circumstances, the only way to help sort of reduce the intensity of that addiction, the recommended approach is to pursue what's called harm reduction, which is exactly what it sounds like, and that is to reduce either the frequency or the nature of the vice. So that would mean perhaps in dealing with, let's say, a drug addiction, perhaps instead of using a certain type of drug, which is potentially much more toxic, it would be to use one that is, that provides a high, but a little less toxic, to reduce the intensity when it comes to exposure to pornographic material. There's another approach where, again, the treatment is not, well, do it less. The treatment is do it less. And it was because if the goal is going to be to just go from one extreme to another, given this person's track record and the particulars, and again, we're talking very general terms right now, that is not something that's going to work. And it's a little different, I think, from the perspective of halacha. It may be different in terms of how we would view that. Over there, we're not necessarily looking to introduce something that is not already part of this person's struggle, but rather give them license to continue, but to do so in a way that will hopefully, again, enable them to find their way out of the desert.
I would just add a few svaras that you can apply or not apply, decide how much they account for. But it's noteworthy that, first of all, the point about the desert that's been mentioned, just to put that in context, the nature of the proof from there is that traveling, if one assumes that we don't know when Shabbos is, so any day is a suffix Shabbos, so if we're going to be machmir on other things, that's one thing. To be machmir on traveling means that right now it's not pikuach nefesh. Okay, you can sit in one place for a day, but the result is going to be that there's no svara to ever be more makel than any other day unless you look at it as the whole picture. You're never going to be able to get out of there, and therefore the cumulative effect of everything, of being machmir on every single case, is going to end up being unlivable. And that's a part of what plays a role in some of these questions. But there are also other gemaras that also contribute to being able to have some leeway, and the question of the sugya of chetei kedei sheyizke chavercha, kedei sheyizke atzmecha, which is somewhat of an unresolved issue, and it draws on a lot of complicated factors, but we sometimes do find that we're able to draw on some kind of a relative assessment. And it's also interesting to consider, especially as Rabbanim, and I think there's a big difference between what we're specifically allowing or instructing or what we get in the way of. And when there's room just not to get in the way, that's something we should really pursue sometimes, especially because even when we are asked a question directly, so a lot of the consideration is that of Lufnei Iver, Lo Sitein Michshol. We don't want to give advice that is harmful. We don't want to be a part of somebody else's Avera. But it's also very possible that the whole Chakira and Lufnei Iver and how exactly to relate to it, but certainly it comes out from a tshuva, widely quoted tshuva of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that it goes to the goal of the, what's actually happening. So if somebody is going to fall, are you making them fall harder or making them fall less? So there is much more license to take a result based approach, especially when you're the one guiding or advising or choosing not to interfere, especially to say that I can look at what's going to be the end result of this process and will there be more of a nefila if I get involved or more of a nefila if I don't get involved, and to allow that to be a part of it.
So we've all dealt with various varying degrees of addictions and different kinds of variations of that. I'm just curious, Rabbi Rothwax, I know the question comes up, you know, many, many times in communities. What do you do when you have an alcoholic who's really been working hard on themselves and really been to therapy and really doing very well, and then they're confronted with Pesach, and they're sitting around the table with people who are all drinking al pi halacha, not doing anything that's uncomfortable, but for that person, it can be extremely damaging. Well, what would you say, what's the suggestion for that individual?
Yeah. So first of all, before we get to the Pesach Seder, there's every other day of the year, and I'll take this opportunity to just remind anybody who's listening how sensitive we need to be. It goes without saying we need to be sensitive to individuals who we know are in various stages of recovery, but we also have to be extra sensitive in considering the fact that there are people who are either in the throes of an addiction or in early or late stages of recovery. You can never truly be truly recovered. That's another important point to mention. And we wouldn't necessarily know that. I distinctly recall once being present at the Shalom Zalcha. I'm sure this happens often, but I just recall there was an individual who was walking around offering everybody drinks. He meant well. He wasn't the Balabas. It doesn't matter. Can I give you L'chaim? And if anybody said no, so he said again, come on, a little. And he went over to one individual who said no. He says, come on, a little. The guy said no. And the third time, the person, he turned red in the face. And he said, I can't have alcohol. Can you please stop asking me? You know, and I don't want to over-dramatize the event. I don't think the entire room heard, but I saw it. And I've seen since these sort of encounters, very, very innocent. So I think we should be very careful. We're not going to get into conversations around now policies, alcohol policies in schools and shuls. Well, shuls, I don't know there are alcohol policies in schools, but it is important to recognize that we should not be offering and serving people drinks. If and when it is appropriate for people and they feel that they're able and that they would like to go ahead and to have a drink, let's leave it up to them. Otherwise, I think we should assume that, and this is assumption based on statistics, and Amudim could provide the numbers, I don't know what they are, but there's a significant number of people in our community who are struggling. And we would never want to in any way whatsoever contribute to that. And then, as you've asked, there are times of the year that we completely cannot avoid the train wreck at all. I think most people can easily manage a Shabbos table, and certainly a Purim Seder, which is a conversation for another time. But the Pesach Seder, you almost can't avoid the question. Now, it's true, this is Machlokas HaPoskim about using grape juice for the purpose of Dalet Kosos, which may be, you know, one solution. But what if that's not enough for this individual? And I think of Rabbi Schechter, if I understood your question correctly, the question was not whether this recovering alcoholic should be drinking wine for Dalet Kosos. It goes without saying that that's something that is not an option. But what if he finds it to be very challenging to be sitting there at the table? So there's two possibilities. One possibility is, well, he'll just have a seder by himself or go elsewhere. Or can we consider the possibility that everyone at that table, well, they'll have like we'll call a dry seder? I mean, I'm gonna pause now and open that as a question. But again, I think that the power to this conversation is in the questions more than the answers. I think that if anybody's listening right now and that question just makes you feel very uncomfortable, I think it's a moment to just reflect for a moment, to understand and appreciate that it could be a very lonely place to begin with, to be in that stage of your life, whatever, and recovering from an addiction, to tell such a person, you know, listen, this is the way we do it. And if it's not comfortable for you, we understand, but, you know, this is the way we do it. It's, you know, either way, the question should weigh on us. My wife was once, we had guests on Shabbos and she was serving chicken and one of our guests complimented on it. She goes, yeah, it's a new recipe. So the guy says, what's the secret ingredient? And she said, beer. And he spit out the chicken right away. And we didn't know how to react. And he said, I'm sorry, I apologize. He said, I've been in recovery for, I don't know, he said like 25 years and I can't touch alcohol. So we were obviously stunned and afraid that maybe we we just set him back 25 years. Thankfully,
he didn't. The alcohol evaporated in the oven? Isn't that a thing? Yeah.
Well, that was the thing. Listen, I guess he was, you know, he's in recovery, Mahajan. He was not going to take any risks. But again, it was just a moment of you just don't know. You just don't know. This was a person that we thought we knew well, and we obviously know much, much better than we did before. And he was actually very comfortable with the disclosure. It hadn't come up before, but it took, and this was not a Pesach Seder or a Purim Seder. This was just, you know, a Shabbos meal, and one of the ingredients was beer. And again, the takeaway message is not that we should eliminate beer and wine from all of our recipes, as much as just understand and appreciate that we don't really know from time to time who we're interacting with. I'll just pivot for a moment, because what this question really puts on the table for this conversation is the possibility that there are times in supporting and helping individuals in various stages of mental health treatment and recovery, other individuals must at least consider the possibility of adjusting their own routine, which for the purpose of our conversation means, you know, considering their own possibilities for their own halachic observance. It's a very unusual type of shaila to ask, but is it permissible for an individual to do an isser which would directly benefit another individual? But I'll share a question that I had years ago and actually sort of resurfaced very recently, right after Yom Tov, that there was a woman, it was a girl, a young girl, a teenage girl, who was in a residential program for an eating disorder. Treatment of eating disorders, I mean, particularly on a residential level, there are different stages. And once the individual who is sort of graduating from one level to the next, they try to get her or him, whatever the case may be, to a point where they could have supervised meals together with members of their family. So in a residential center, they're usually not living with their family, obviously, but the parents will come in. If it's from out of town, they'll come in for a few days and they'll have supervised meals. So the situation was like this. The girl was in a program and they told her going in that the food is kosher. The truth of the matter is most of the food probably was kosher, but it wasn't up to their standards. They told her that it's not going to be necessary to serve basar b'chalav, which never it is. They weren't going to make her have, you know, bacon, but, you know, were all the cheeses and all the yogurts necessarily, you know, with an OU? Probably not. And this particular facility was not interested in accommodating that. And I do want to point out that in my experience, which is, it is what it is, some of the eating disorder facilities that are less accommodating in this regard tend to provide a much better type of treatment, because they just run a very, very tight ship and they're just very much on top of things. It's not, they're not looking to be probably, you know, difficult, and it's not, they're not against halacha, religious observance. They're just trying to, they have a much bigger consideration. So this girl had been there for months and under the impression that everything that she was eating was kosher. And her parents came in for a supervised meal and the parents were told, don't worry, we're going to have special food for you. And the parents came into the room and they were sitting at a table and discovered, lo and behold, that those accommodations were not offered to them. So this was a question, thankfully, that came my way after the fact. They couldn't do anything in the moment, and they were right then and there. And I guess the shilat that they had in the moment is, what do we do? We sort of keep this lie going. It's hard to, I find it hard to speak this shilat through without feeling the intensity and the emotion at the time. You know, what do we do? We've made it this far. She's doing well. Do we just sort of keep the lie going, or do we hesitate and say to the lady, you know, I can't have this cheese. I, you know, do you have anything else?
I'm just curious, what do the Rabbanim feel about mental health? How does that fit into the picture of Shabbos? You know, we have very clear guidelines regarding Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos when it's somebody's life. We have guidelines with regards to Shmad on Shabbos, as the Shulchan Aruch writes. But what about when you have somebody, who has a mental health issue and that collides with Shabbos? How do you approach that?
I think I'm going to jump in here because for the most part I'm standing on the side when Rabbi Feldman and Rabbi Leibowitz can weigh in on halachic issues. But correct me if I'm wrong. Would we not look at every mental health issue as we would any health issue and try to figure out, you know, how to classify the level of illness? Is it mechash ba'alma? Is it cholesh embo sakana? Sheish bo sakana? The chiddush being, of course, that yeah, mental health issues can in fact create a situation where a person is a genuine chola. I think that, you know, we would not necessarily have had that same understanding, appreciation, sensitivity a couple of generations ago. But now that we are where we are, not all mental health issues are created equal, and depending on the diagnosis, the prognosis, the situation, the treatment, you know, we would have to apply, you know, whatever rules when it comes to a physical illness. But tell me if I'm wrong.
I would certainly think so. You know, I would certainly think there's all kinds of different levels. There are conditions which certainly pose an immediate risk to life, which should have that realization and that consequence. There are those which pose a cumulative risk to life, and that I think we've addressed a little bit and seen that there's recognition of that impact as well. And then there are things that are incapacitating or create tremendous tsar, and that may not have the same level of impact on halachic permissibility, but it certainly is significant when dealing with a number of things that come up in Hilchos Shabbos, and the question is how to assess within each one. But I think there's no question that if we had a credible reason to believe that somebody's physical health and physical well-being is at stake, so then the logic should fit, even if we're not comfortable making klalim and we're worried about how that might be misapplied. But the svara is certainly there, and it's there in very early sources, and to appreciate what that might mean.
Just from your experience, I'm curious, what do the Rabbanim feel would be some direction maybe for family members or community members to make themselves a little bit more sensitive, to try to sensitize ourselves as a entire community? From the experiences that you've had, is there something you can share that maybe people who are watching can walk away with and allow themselves to feel a little bit more of a sensitivity? Or are there places in religious life in things that we do in Minhagim that we're part of that maybe we can add an extra dose of sensitivity toward those who might be struggling and we're not even being mindful or aware of it?
Well, to go back to a previous point, because I think it's also relevant, the question about the drinking at the Seder. So the question was raised, should we ask everyone to have a dry Seder if one individual there needs to be avoiding alcohol completely? So that's one question that's fair to ask. But separate from whether that actually has to be as far, that step has to actually be taken, but the attitude that we convey about the drinking, and this would certainly benefit us if all year round we were aware of just how harmful it is for people to be exposed to an attitude that sees drinking as the be-all and end-all of human experience, and to recognize just what impact that has, whether somebody is a recovering, or like Rothweck said, a not yet recovering alcoholic, or somebody is just potentially at risk for alcoholism or for any of the tremendous harm that can come. And the whole culture that has developed, that it's portrayed as the most enjoyable activity and the most uplifting activity possible. So there's a lot we can do to change that culture. So whether it means that everyone at the Seder is not drinking alcohol, and if grape juice is an option, it may be realistic to ask everybody at the table to drink grape juice. And I think that would probably be a tremendous statement that would be enormously appreciated by somebody who's there and wouldn't involve that much halachic compromise. But even if we didn't go that far, just if we related to those who were drinking at the Seder, related to it more as a mitzvah rather than as something that they are enjoying tremendously for reasons that go beyond the mitzvah. So I would throw out the question, let's say you had somebody at the table, at the Seder table, who had celiac and couldn't eat matzah. So let's say that individual wasn't eating matzah. Would he feel the same kind of pressure from everyone else eating matzah as the recovering alcoholic feels when he's not able to drink wine? Is it simply that he's not doing what everyone else is doing? Or is there more about the culture that makes this more tempting and that elevates this beyond the mitzvah status, and that if it was viewed more as a mitzvah rather than that which else, everything else that comes with it, it might be easier for someone to say, okay, so I have a personal condition that doesn't allow me to do that mitzvah. There's things like that that happen to people all over, and I'll sit this one out, and it won't necessarily have the same effect.
I think also the more we talk about these things publicly, this kind of event is very helpful, that people should hear that these things actually happen. For a long time, there was, and still remains to some degree, a culture in our community of just hiding mental health issues, addiction issues. I think Amudim has done a great deal of work in terms of bringing this to light, even if it just involves saying statistics of how many people were lost to suicide or drug overdoses, how many young people, where it used to be, wow, we have a high rate of aneurysms in our community, where now we realize that, and we're able to say that, no, this person had a disease. They had a severe depression. They had an addiction. And you know, the more it happens, sadly, there are two ways we can learn about it. One is where a person has it in their family and they're exposed to it directly, and they gain a high level of sensitivity toward these things. And the other is just by talking about it more publicly.
I would add as well that it would go a long way for us to appreciate that there are features of our community, I think more cultural than halachic, but you know, the line between the two can sometimes be blurred, that may present some individuals who are struggling at sort of a heightened risk. If you like, think about food as an example. We have a community that is very, I would say, on a communal level, very obsessed with food. Some of that is because, you know, there are a lot of times that we need to eat. There's a chiyuv suda, you know, every Shabbos three times. But beyond that, I think we have, you know, culturally, our community has adopted in a way, has adapted rather in a way that you know has really has we speak a lot about food, and we talk about a lot about the presentation of food and all that, and we have to understand and appreciate that while that may be very satisfying and enjoyable and fulfilling for some, it may be very triggering to others. It's always already been mentioned that there are certain times throughout the year where alcohol is an important part of our experience as Jews. We have to understand and appreciate that very feature, which makes our community unique and special, also again can be challenging for some. I think that the levels of stress that already teenagers and particularly, you know, people who are trying to support their families are subjected to in order to have to support the lifestyles that are demanded of us in our communities, the stress is real and it takes a toll. And for somebody who's already predisposed and already struggles with anxiety, depression, could literally push them over the edge, and in some cases does. When we are sort of, when we deny that and we want to be overly defensive and say, no, it can't be, it's a mitzvah, so therefore it has to be always good, or this is what we do, and this is the way I was raised, and it worked for me, and so therefore there can't be anything wrong with that. I think it's a very narrow-minded perspective, but it's an attitude when we hear that could be actually very hurtful to some, and does exactly the opposite of what conversations like this are designed to do, and that is make people feel comfortable in sort of talking about some of their issues and their struggles and trying to seek help. And we also point out that I think our community has some very unique protective factors. I mean, the fact that we are such a strong community and we have the infrastructure and the ability to produce conversations like this, as an example, and really reach so many people, I think is showing that, you know, this very community, that it's, you know, it's difficult and challenging sometimes to maintain an equilibrium within, you know, provides me with the resources and the support, and the hope and the desire and the motivation to be able to push forward. So speaking about it honestly, openly, without being defensive, and all questions are good questions. I've seen over the course of the last 10 years alone, and I think people who have been paying attention for longer could probably say over the last 20 or 30 years, a significant reduction in terms of the stigma around mental health issues. I don't know that we could ever, you know, we're not there yet. I'm not sure what it means to be there, but I think we're doing very well. Baruch Hashem as a community.
In particular, the stigma around therapy has really, really, thank God, in many circles been almost reversed. There are certain places where, like, if you're not in therapy, like, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you talking to somebody? I had an experience a couple of summers ago where I run a program for guys who are learning, 18, 19 year old guys who are learning all day over the summer. And there's always a counselor or two, someone who's 21, 22, 23, that the boys look up to and that they admire. And one particular occasion, it was a Friday night and we were schmoozing and we were just going around the room and I was asking the boys, what's the nicest thing anyone's ever done for you? Can you share something that like really uplifted you that someone else did for you? And, most of the boys were saying, my parents did this, my Rebbe did this. And the counselor, the one who they all looked up to as the coolest guy in the room, as the one that he said, well, my therapist, I never would have been able to date or get married if not for my therapist, in front of all of these kids that were looking up to him. And I was thinking, 10 years ago, would that have ever happened? Would that, it was even surprising to me now, but I think we're making great progress.
So thank you to all the Rabbanim for joining. And we just want to, once again, give a tremendous yashar kvach to Amudim for the unbelievable and incredible work that they do for so many individuals and for so many of our communities. And you are a indispensable resource for the work that the community needs and for the help that so many individuals require. And we're so grateful to you, and we hope that all who are watching will help in this effort, in this Unite to Heal effort, to support the work of Amudim, to allow them to continue to help our community to be strong, to be healthy, and to continue on in the journey serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the best way we possibly can.
Thank you.
Thank you.